to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is the universal aspect of his personality. Quran is a miracle given to Rasul, and Ali is also a miracle given to Rasul. Quran is a universal book, and Ali is a universal personality. When you look at this concept of Quran being the universal book, what it means is that this is the last revelation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There were revelations which came before, and they were true. We cannot be a Muslim if we deny the truth of Torah and Injil and the books which came before. But then this was the final one. With coming of the Quran, everything else is to be respected. But when it comes to implementation, it is the Quran. This is the era of the Quran. And with the last prophet, this became the last book. It is universal in a sense that it is not bound by time and space. It is not only for the people who lived during the days of the prophet. Quran is not a source of guidance only for the Arabian Peninsula or for the people who lived in the 7th century. It is a source of guidance for all the people till the day of Qiyamah and all parts of the world. That is the meaning of universality of the Quran. When you look at Amir al-Mu'mineen, he is a universal personality in a sense that his life and his words and the examples that he provided in the short life that he had, especially in the last 5 years of his Khilafah, these are not bound by time and space. The example of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the words of wisdom and whatever he left behind as a legacy, this has acquired its own universal form. It is applicable and a source of guidance for all the people and for all parts of the world.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It is widely believed that the war in Ukraine is causing a global food crisis. But how could this be true? Ukraine is one of the world's biggest exporters of green essentials, like wheat and corn. But most of its products can't even leave the country. This is causing serious problems in places where they depend most on this supply, like the Middle East and Africa. There's so many ripple effects from the war, but it's hard to overstate just how big the impact of the grain crisis is. Along with the shortages, you've also got the rising prices of fertilizers and fuel, as well as natural disasters due to climate change like drought, which has only further worsened the situation globally. And now UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of a global food crisis as the West's anti-Russia stance is creating obstacles to the flow of Russian products and fertilizers to the world. Guterres said that the global food crisis triggered by the Ukraine conflict looms over the world. The UN chief says the West's sanctions on Russia have exacerbated the poor situation of the global economy.
They are trying to use all kinds of arguments. Some are, real, based on something. Some are absolutely spurious and based on nothing, to somehow get the public opinion against Russia. And that concerns this story of grain. Russia and other countries produce you know, much more grain than Ukraine. So the very idea that Africa will somehow starve, not because of misguided Western policies, not because of the prices which, you know, West commands, but because five boats of grain which cannot leave Odessa, it's a joke. There were tons of possibilities for even that grain to go, and there is endless amount of possibilities to get grain from Russia, from France, and so on. So that was all mobilized by Ukraine to somehow turn the opinions that it's like all Russia fault. You know, children are dying in Africa, Russian fault, isn't it? And unfortunately, Antonio Guterres, rather than approaching the whole thing objectively, coming to the, you know, to the territory, exploring it, asking questions, saying, what can we do? He more or less channels the information which is given to him by Ukraine.
But despite this, only a few nations seem to be pushing for diplomatic efforts in an attempt to restore the global supply chains, and other countries, mainly the US and its allies, continue their anti-Russia stance, pushing ahead with their foreign policy. The impact of the West's war on Russia through sanctions can be felt globally. Global supply chains have been disrupted, fears of food shortages are rising, and countries' economies have also taken a hit. But despite the heavy costs incurred by the people worldwide, the US and many European leaders seem to have set their eyes on pushing ahead with their sanctions policy instead of opting for diplomacy. Russia is a major exporter of potash, ammonia, urea, and other soil nutrients, and the supply of all these fertilizers, which are necessities for efficient production of corn, soy, rice, and wheat, has been heavily disrupted as a result of Western sanctions on Russia. A clear example of this would be Brazilian farmers, who are forced to use less fertilizers considering the shortages created in their country. In some African countries, farmers are reverting to using manure to nourish their crops. And in North America, some farmers have stockpiled fertilizers for the 2023 season in anticipation of higher prices. Meanwhile, in the United States, fertilizer bills are expected to jump 12% this year, and that's according to the American Farm Bureau Federation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA data.
No, I think the whole war is definitely, you know, war in general is, should be avoided. But this one is just very cynical calculation. Somehow the leadership of NATO, leadership in Washington, decided that it's a win-win situation. A, we, you know, get opinion against Russia. B, we'll get sanctions against Russia, which will benefit us, our gas companies, our oil companies, our military companies. And see, it even has a chance to weaken Russia, which is like our enemy, to weaken Russia militarily. So they're pumping Ukraine with military forces. They're trying to push them to the battlefield. In the battlefield, Russians are killed, Ukrainians are killed in great numbers, while, you know, leadership, Ukrainian leadership buys fancy cars for themselves and send, and they don't send their children to the front. They send some poor people to the front. So this is just exercising the bloodshed, out of which many people hope to, you know, get some economic benefit.
But while standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. Instead of following diplomacy similar to Turkey in an attempt to solve the ongoing crisis, the West continues to follow its warmongering aspirations and further sanction Russia. The fall of the US dollar is happening, 1 cent at a time. While there's a decline in the US standing as a superpower, there's also the harsh reality that the US is facing, the decline of the US dollar. All the signs are there. Shares of the US dollar in reserves held by central banks has fallen to its lowest level. The US, the most indebted nation ever, also has a sovereign debt crisis, another sign that it may be heading to a dollar collapse. The US use of the dollar as a weapon, like sanctions, has made other countries resist using it in their trade. Yet countries like Iran, Russia, and China are moving towards the elimination of the dollar altogether. This is why Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin has said, against the growing geopolitical pressure from the collective West, the only way to guarantee stable trade, economic and investment ties between Russia and its partners is to avoid the dollar and the euro and switch to settlements in acceptable alternatives, primarily in national currencies. His reference to the growing geopolitical pressure from the West are sanctions from the US and its European allies due to Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. But these sanctions have been heavily used against Russia starting from the year 2014.
When it comes to trade, if you want to move away from the dollar, as opposed to Russian ruble, it's going to be very difficult indeed. Of course, you can trade in ruble and other currencies, but the key thing is you need them to be liquid. That's easy to buy and sell and a decent size. And also the margin, or the difference between the buying and selling costs, all of this can make it more difficult. Therefore, if you're trading in dollars, the price is normally going to be sharper. If you're trading in, say, another currency, well, you may find it's illiquid, as barren as a desert, and not be able to complete your trade.
The de-dollarization move was thrown into fast gear when the US Treasury Department decided to confiscate Russia's dollar foreign exchange reserves. This made other countries think twice about holding their reserves in the dollar currency. After all, these countries have concluded that their country could be the next if it does not abide by US foreign policy. They can be a victim of secondary sanctions at a minimum. Therefore, it was a natural progression for countries like Russia, China, and Iran to trade with their own national currencies. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin has said that mechanisms for settlement in national currencies other than Western ones have been successfully created with a number of nations, and the possibility of paying in rubles for certain categories of Russian export goods, including energy and food products, has been set up.
It's going to be interesting to see actually what happens with the dollar now, because I suspect there's going to be quite a lot of weakness of it. Why? Well, because the global economy is slowing down for one key reason. But nonetheless, dollar is normally seen as a safer haven than other currencies. So what you'll find is actually people will go to the dollar in times of emergency because they know it's actually got depth, liquidity, and obviously the treasury standing behind it. If you were using another currency, those things would not be as strong and it would not be as straightforward to be able to run a business like that.
The BRICS, SCO and other international platforms have intensified their multilateral discourse on the subject. And this is very significant since the US has fallen out of favor with many countries and are gravitating eastward or away from the US. Take the case of Brazil. Presidential candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has recommended using a Latin American currency to be free of the US dollar. Lula has pledged many things that don't involve the US and the dollar, such as strengthening its relations with Latin America, vowing to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture to challenge Western financial hegemony. The BRICS have also been discussing the development of a BRICS pay multilateral wallet and currency.
Early on Thursday, the Israeli military has shot down 7 Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. The military broke into the offices of the organizations and confiscated property. Palestinians' foreign ministry has censored the raid as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice, saying rights groups remain the prime target of the regime because they document its crimes against Palestinians. 6 of the organizations raided had been criminalized as terrorist organizations in October 2021 by Israel, which claimed they were affiliated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless. The organizations targeted on Thursday work in fields such as human rights, prisoner support, children's rights, and healthcare. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations by Israel, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bissan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees. Since 1967, Israel has banned more than 400 local and international organizations, including all major Palestinian political parties. Analysts speculate that Israel had attacked the groups because they were becoming increasingly effective at exposing Israel's repression of Palestinian people.
That their Achilles heel is their ongoing horrific violations of human rights, which are losing them support throughout the world. And so they're apparently thinking that they can kill the messenger and get rid of those who are reporting on their crimes just by shutting them down on spurious pretenses.
The Israeli army has deprived generations of Palestinians in the West Bank of their basic civil rights, including the right to expression, regularly using military force to suppress Palestinian people. The latest raid on Palestinian non-governmental human rights organizations and their designations as terrorist organizations have been denounced by UN experts and were rejected by 9 European states that fund targeted groups. The European countries also called Israel's allegations against the NGOs unsubstantiated. Last year, Israel's leading human rights group, B'Tselem, said in a report that Israel is not a democracy but an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws, is using laws, practices, and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another.
Israel is obviously trying to silence the voices of critics who've been documenting the ongoing abuses of human rights, the murders of children, shooting down teenagers, bombing targets, and killing all sorts of people, often at random. They're essentially ongoing massacres, not to mention the torture, which is a systematic feature of Israeli policy.
Israeli policies and practices toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories should be scrutinized, but only condemning Israeli raids on Palestinian civil society groups is not enough. It's high time the UN and international organizations took direct action against Israeli atrocities.
Tensions are rising between Turkey and Syria. Ankara has launched airstrikes on military posts in northern Syria, killing several army soldiers and injuring several more. There are now concerns that a military operation in northern Syria by Turkish forces is imminent. Sources say a new cross-border offensive by Turkey looms large. Turkish forces have reportedly used loudspeakers in mosques in border areas close to the Jarablus city to ask people to stay indoors in preparation for the operation. Reports also say numerous Turkish combat drones could be seen flying in the skies over areas in proximity to the frontier. Turkish soldiers are also mobilizing in most of the border towns of Hasaka, Raqqa, and Aleppo provinces. The Turkish president has already hinted at a possible military incursion. On August 8th, Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara's decision to establish a 30-kilometer deep secure line along the country's southern border is final. Ankara says it's going to curb Kurdish militants operating in that area.
They want actually to annex the northern part of Syria. This is an ambition that Turkey has to regain, to enlarge some territory that it once had. And I think this is not something that is acceptable either to Syria or even to Russia. Russia wants to have good relations with Turkey, but not at this price, I think.
The US-backed Kurdish People's Protection Unit, or YPG, militant group, which is the backbone of SDF, is present there. Ankara says YPG militants are terrorists. Damascus has warned Ankara against violating its sovereignty. Both Iran and Russia, which have been aiding Damascus in its anti-terror campaign, are also against Turkey's possible offensive. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019. Back then, Turkish forces launched a cross-border invasion to push YPG militants away. Since 2016, Turkey has launched three military operations inside Syria. When the crisis began on Syria in 2011, Ankara-backed militants fighting against the government in Damascus. For years, it provided them with weapons and military support in a bid to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So this is perhaps just a what we sometimes call a red herring, that is something that will distract the observers from what is actually going on. It makes it appear, makes Turkey appear to be reasonable, when in fact they don't have a reasonable agenda at all. They have an unreasonable agenda.
However, there are signs that Turkey may have changed its policy on Syria. Just recently, it was revealed that the Turkish foreign minister had a brief conversation with his Syrian counterpart last October. The top Turkish diplomat has stressed that there needs to be a reconciliation between opposition groups and the Damascus government. There are reports that Ankara was evaluating the possibility of starting talks with the Syrian government. The leader of Turkey's Nationalist Movement Party has also supported comments to mend relations with neighboring Syria. Turkey now appears to be in a difficult position. The country's economy is now in its worst situation in decades. It's spending nearly $2 billion in northern Syria annually. And sentiments against Syrian refugees in Turkey are rising. That could potentially cost Erdogan his political career. In order to fix it, Erdogan needs to establish relations with Syria.
I think it's going to be a major problem. The Turkish attack indicates that they are not going to accept a reasonable compromise and to respect the territorial integrity of Syria. So this is going to be a major problem.
But at the same time, Ankara does not want to lose Syria card with regards to anti-Assad militants. However, its possible military adventure in northern Syria could trigger another catastrophe in a country which is in the midst of a prolonged crisis.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از
Self purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. Thank you.
یعنی آقایون، خواهرها، تو گرفتاری های مادی جسمی ارتباط معنوی داشته باشید.
The family of Hazrat Fatimah al-Zahra is admired by Allah in Surah Al-Insan, Ayah 8. One of the main reasons is their trust in Allah when facing a problem in life. The behavior of Imam Ali alayhi salam and Hazrat Fatimah al-Zahra salamullah alayha shows us how to have hope in Allah and to strengthen our spiritual relation to Allah. Now, some people lose their hope when they become sick or they face a problem in life. This family also was fearful of Allah's chastisement on the Day of Judgment.
این خانواده‌ای که بهشت در انتظار اینهاست از شر قیامت می‌ترسند.
Although they were the most righteous people of Islam and their presence in heaven is guaranteed by Allah, they never disobeyed Allah and they always were humble before Allah. This is a good lesson for today's family. If we believe in the other world, then we will be more careful about the consequences of our bad deeds. Sense of awe and fear before Allah helps us to be more cautious in life. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRab English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
One super spreader with Omicron shed 1,000 times as much viral RNA as those with Alpha or Delta. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Mackenzie Prillman, writer. This article is published under the heading, "How much virus does a person with COVID exhale?" New research has the answers. Stay tuned for more. People infected with the highly transmissible Alpha, Delta, and Omicron variants of SARS-CoV-2 spew out higher amounts of virus than those infected with other variants, according to a new study. Furthermore, individuals who contract COVID-19 after vaccination and even after a booster dose still shed virus into the air. The work was posted on the MedRevix preprint server on July 29th. It has not yet been peer-reviewed. John Walkens, a public health engineer at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, said, "This research showed that all three of those variants that have won the infection race come out of the body more efficiently when people talk or shout than the earliest strains of the coronavirus." The study co-author Kristen Coleman, who researches emerging infectious diseases at the University of Maryland in College Park, says this means that people should be pushing governments to invest in improving indoor air quality by improving ventilation and filtration systems. For the study, Coleman and her colleagues recruited 93 people between mid-2020 and early 2022 who were infected with SARS-CoV-2. Participants' infections were caused by strains including the Alpha variant, which emerged in late 2020, and the later Delta and Omicron variants. All participants with the latter two strains had been fully vaccinated before catching the virus. The infected people faced into a cone-shaped apparatus and sang and shouted, with the inevitable coughs and sneezes in between, for 30 minutes, while an attached machine collected the particles they exhaled. The device, called a Jasondite second, separated out the fine aerosol droplets measuring 5 micrometers or less in diameter, which can linger in the air and leak through cloth and surgical masks. The team found that participants infected with the Alpha, Delta, and Omicron variants emitted significantly more viral RNA when exhaling than did people infected with other variants. These include ancestral variants, such as the one first detected in China, and those not associated with increased transmissibility, such as Gamma, which arose in late 2020. For participants with Delta and Omicron, their fine aerosol contained on average 5 times the amount of virus that was detected in their larger, coarse aerosol. The team also seeded out cells in the lab with aerosol samples and found that 4 samples, each from a participant with either Delta or Omicron, infected the cells. Shed virus is not always infectious, says study co-author Gianni Lai, an epidemiologist at the University of Maryland, and the sample's ability to infect lab cells means that viral RNA in exhaled aerosols can spread the disease. Malin Alsvedt, an aerosol technology scientist at Lund University in Sweden, said, "I'm a bit concerned that they mix all their respiratory aerosols. They have breathing, talking, speaking, screaming, coughing, even sneezing in the sample." Coleman responds that the team combined respiratory samples to mimic a real-life scenario, such as being in a restaurant. The study also highlights variation between individuals in the amounts of exhaled virus, which ranged from non-detectable levels to those associated with super spreaders. One Omicron-infected participant, for example, shed 1,000 times as much viral RNA through fine aerosol as the maximum level observed in those with Alpha or Delta. The researchers say that the root of these discrepancies remains a mystery, but could be related to biological factors such as a person's age. Behavior might play a part too. This study's super spreader coughed more frequently than others. If new variants are more prone to super spreading, that might drive them to dominate COVID-19 cases. The team notes that people infected with SARS-CoV-2 exhale much lower amounts of viral RNA than do people infected with influenza, a comparable airborne disease. This suggests that SARS-CoV-2 could spin off variants that transmit even more virus.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the kindness and affection of our Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And in today's lesson, we are talking about the kindness and the affection that Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam had. Among the qualities of the father of the martyrs was that he had great affection for the people and offered his help to those who needed his help. He used to reach for the assistance of all those who needed it. And for anyone who sought his refuge, he used to accord to him. In other words, Imam Hussein alayhi salam listened to everyone. Whatever problem you had, he could sit down and listen to you, regardless of your stage of life, regardless of your economic status. He never stood and said, maybe you're a poor person, I cannot listen to you. You're this kind of a person, I cannot listen to you. No, he listened to everyone and took care of everyone according to their needs.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano, and we are talking about the kindness of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. We say that he was very kind. He gave everyone time. He listened to everyone's problem, and he took care of everyone who needed him. He needed his care. So among the obvious examples of the Imam's kindness is the episode concerning Hur ibn Yazid al-Riyahi, who was accompanied with 1,000 soldiers, and they had been sent to confront the Imam alayhi salam. But when they came face to face with the holy Imam alayhi salam, they had already run out of drinking water and were all on the verge of death due to extreme thirst that they faced during the time. When the holy Imam alayhi salam saw their serious condition, he was having sufficient quantities of water with him, and he supplied all of them with water and even provided it to their mounts. Among the forces of Hur was an old man who was so shaking so violently that he could not hold the mouth of the water bag steady to drink the water. So the Imam held the water bag for him and made him steady with his own hands. These actions were the most prominent examples in the culture of humanity that are recorded in the pages of history, and that portray the kindness and the affection that Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam used to have towards the people he used to be leading, towards the people that he lived with during his time of life. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, inshallah. Until next episode, fi amanillah, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence fills the air until his brother Abbas says,
in the limelight.
This is a completely under-the-radar news story, one that was curiously absent from the headlines in all of the major newspapers this morning, wrote one expert after the latest U.S. strike on Somalia. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Corporate Media Mostly Mom as U.S. Strikes Kill at Least 20 in Somalia. Here's the story. Monitors have recently drew attention to a series of U.S. airstrikes in Somalia in recent months, attacks that have received relatively little attention in the American corporate media, despite having reportedly killed more than 20 people. If you were unaware that we were bombing Somalia, don't feel bad. This is a completely under-the-radar news story, one that was curiously absent from the headlines in all of the major newspapers this morning, wrote Kelly Bikar Velahus, a senior advisor at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Recently, anti-war's Dave DeCamp reported that U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, launched its second strike on Somalia in a week. AFRICOM said its initial assessment found the attack, which occurred in Beledweyne and killed 13 fighters belonging to the Al-Qaeda-linked Somali militant group Al-Shabaab, and that no civilians were harmed. AFRICOM also said it killed 4 Al-Shabaab members in 3 separate airstrikes near Beledweyne on August 9th, 2 fighters in a joint U.S.-Somali operation near Labi Kas on July 17th, and 5 militants in a June 3rd bombing outside Beer Shani. All of these strikes have taken place since U.S. President Joe Biden approved the redeployment of hundreds of special forces troops to Somalia in May, reversing a drawdown from the war-ravaged nation implemented during the administration of former President Donald Trump. The camp noted that Trump's withdrawal from Somalia merely repositioned troops in neighboring Djibouti and Kenya, allowing the drone war to continue. But Biden has launched significantly fewer strikes in Somalia compared to his predecessor. According to data from the UK-based monitor group Air Wars, US forces have bombed Somalia at least 16 times during Biden's tenure, killing between 465 and 545 suspected militants. On March 13th, a joint US drone and Somali airstrike killed a staggering 200 alleged militants. Air Wars identified civilian casualties in just one of the attacks during Biden's presidency, a June 2021 strike attributed to either U.S. or Kenyan forces, which have been battling Al-Shabaab since 2011. The attack on the southern town of Silkad killed Sahra Adan Warsaim and seriously injured five of her children, according to local media reports. Since 2007, the U.S. military has carried out 260 actions in Somalia, while the Pentagon only admits to killing five civilians and wounding 11 others in a campaign it claims killed as many as 3,010 militants. Air Wars estimates that 78 to 153 civilians, including 20 to 23 children, have died in U.S. attacks. Bottom line, it's been a long time since the United States was not bombing Somalia, wrote Vallahos, adding, this comes after a particularly bloody period during the so-called War on Terror, in which the CIA was using the country to detain and torture terror suspects from across North Africa. She added, whether this has ultimately been a good thing for the country or for the broader security of the region, one need only to look at the continued instability and impoverishment of the people, and of course, the persistent presence of Al-Shabaab itself.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23rd, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
I have frequently said that if the poems that you recite in the beginning contain moral lessons, they are very valuable. They should be ideological as well as moral. For example, some but not all of Saib's sonnets are truly valuable. Today, our poets who compose poems with a religious theme, especially about the lives of the Imams, are working on these matters as well. I should add that you elegists and poets who compose poems with a religious theme help one another. Your elegists help to improve their poetry. By reciting their poems, you arouse the excitement of these poets and help them to improve their poems. So you help the poet and the poet helps you as well. When you recite good poems in the morning ceremonies, you are in fact giving value to your own position. Well, this important movement, taking people into the depths of history and purifying and polishing hearts, requires art and artistic methods. In our elegies, this kind of art shows itself in the voice, in the song, and in the geometry of the recitation. These three things are definitely needed. A good elegist should have a good voice, a good song. In Arabic, this is rhythm and tone. And he should also know the geometry for reciting.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, some people know the latter and some do not. This is important to determine what you want to do in the morning ceremonies from the beginning. These things constitute the form of an elegist: a good voice, a good song, and a good management of one's recitation. These constitute the form. But the form should not take precedence over the content. All these things are instruments to be used for the content. One should not act in such a way that the content is lost. The teachings, affection, kindness, and that which gives direction to the movement society from the heart of the Hay'at should not be undermined and lost. This was another point about elegies. Another point is that in elegies, like in all other tasks, innovation and creativity are necessary. As you have witnessed, young people do innovative things in this area. In elegies, innovativeness is good and all right, but you should be careful that this innovativeness does not lead to the breaking of norms. Elegies have a special identity. Therefore, this identity should not be changed.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969. 53 years ago, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds was set on fire by an Australian Zionist named Dennis Michael Rohan in coordination with Israel officials and military forces. Hundreds of people attended the national conference, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
We warned the Zionist enemy against making any stupid moves towards the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. We're willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We call on all Arab leaders to boycott the Israeli regime because it poses a great threat to all nations.
Soon after the arson attack, the Israeli regime increased the Judaization and settlement building in Al-Quds. Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes normalizing ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The shameful normalization of ties between Arab countries and the Israeli regime is encouraging our enemy to carry out further attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Arab governments must stop encouraging the Israeli regime to violate the rights of the Palestinian people and their sacred sites. Al-Quds is the core of the Palestinian struggle.
This year's anniversary comes amid an escalation in Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims and Palestinians who consider it as the capital of their future state.
Al-Quds will always be in the heart of the Islamic nation, and all attempts by the Israeli regime to change its status are doomed to fail. On this sad occasion, we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support Al-Quds and to support Palestine.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the heart of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A timeless beauty that tells stories from Iran's rich artistic heritage. Persian carpets are on display in the 29th Iranian Handwoven Carpet Show in Tehran. The event has brought under one roof producers of hand-woven carpets and pictorial rugs from across the country to showcase their latest designs.
The Persian carpet represents the identity of Iranians. Today, you can see machine-made carpets which are significantly lower in quality compared to the hand-woven ones. So this expo helps reintroduce the importance of hand-woven rugs to the people.
For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented Iran's culture and art. Its unique design and quality have turned the ancient handicraft into a lucrative commodity on the global stage. Less than three decades ago, this sublime art used to be a major export earner for Iran, a viable source of income that accounted for almost one-fifth of the country's non-oil revenues. But today, this is no longer the case, as producers are warning that the Iranian carpet is losing its shine in the global market. From an annual revenue of up to $1 billion in the 1990s, the export of Iranian carpets has slumped to almost zero. One reason behind this freefall has to do with U.S. sanctions, says carpet trader who used to export to Europe before Washington's anti-Iran measures tightened the screw on the Persian carpet.
In the wake of the sanctions, it's safe to say that our carpet exports have dropped to almost zero. Complications in money transfer are one of the impacts of the sanctions, and the unwillingness of foreign clients to buy from us is the other result, because they fear U.S. punishment if they interact with us.
In 2018, another challenge came into play to knock the Persian carpet out of the global market once and for all. Surprisingly, it's a domestic issue. Since the depreciation of the Iranian rial, the government has imposed tight controls on currency liquidity, which require exporters to return their hard currency proceeds to the country within a very short period of time.
The government is not helping us, yet it's been creating problems for us by the so-called currency treaty. It's impossible to retain the proceeds within only 2 months. We need time to sell our carpets in foreign countries where demand for our hand-woven carpets has declined.
The absence of genuine Iranian carpets in the international market has given way to other rivals to fill the void. Countries such as India, Pakistan, and even Afghanistan have since been supplying the market with cheap and fake copies of Iranian carpets, says this young carpet trader.
India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, they are just representing their tableau rugs and carpets with lower prices. The density of their carpets are lower than Iranian carpets, the colors. And also, if you just use them in your houses, you can see that they